Welcome to the Mother of All Movement podcast with me, Catherine Meadows. I'm a women's health trainer specialising in postnatal recovery and a mum to two kids myself. My aim is to inspire and educate through chats with women who are either working through their own movement journey or work to help women get stronger and recover both physically and mentally after having kids. I want to talk about what they do, how they integrate it into their family lives, and essentially, why. Because I believe when we share our stories and our values, we lift each other up, enabling every mother to fulfill her body's potential, gain confidence in her power, and give her family the best version of her to share their lives with. So join me each week to hear these wonderful women talk about their journey. Welcome to the Mother of All Movement podcast, everybody. I'm your host, Catherine Meadows, and today I want to warmly welcome Libby Ayres and Felicity Ashley to the podcast. They are half of the amazing crew of the Mothership, who have just recently raced the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge row this year, coming in at just over 40 days in the race from La Gomera to Antigua. Libby and Dids, as Felicity is known, were joined by crewmates Jo Blackshaw and Pippa Edwards in this amazing, huge challenge. And of course, their boat, Mrs. Nelson, and supported by all of their families at home with 11 children amongst them and so many other people who got behind them all along the way. And I've had great fun today reading through all of their posts and reminding myself of all the support and encouragement that they've had and people following their dots along the way. So Libby and Dids, thank you so much for joining me this evening. So I'm sure you're really busy and with work and coming back and talking about your amazing challenge as well.
Thank you for having us. It's really good to be here.
Good. So I know that, Libby, you came into the crew slightly later on. So do you want to sort of introduce how the crew got together and where your part came into it? Or maybe is that, did that come from you or who wants to?
Yeah, well, maybe Dids is probably a better place to explain how the crew got together, because it was, so it's her sister, Pippa, who was the driving for behind the Mothership, and you know, and the sort of real impetus about how the crew got together. So yeah, Dids, do you want to tell that story?
So it all began really 2 years before our race, when my brother-in-law David took part in a crew called the Felix Five. So the five of them that did it in the same boat in Mr. Nelson. And I always remember finding out that he was doing this thing, thinking he was absolutely mad, thinking why would anyone want to do that, you know, just to me, the thought of being in a tiny little boat in the middle of the Atlantic with those waves was just mind-bogglingly frightening. Couldn't think of anything worse. But then, you know, like many people have watched us doing it, I watched him, I tracked him, you know, I got hooked on the updates. And suddenly this thing that seemed completely mad just, you know, took hold. And I think it captivated, you know, anyone that was tracking him. And then watching him come in live on Facebook in the middle of the night, it was so spine-tinglingly exciting. You know, I just thought, wow, if it feels like that for me to be watching, and I'm, you know, several people removed from it in another country, what must it be like to do that? And at that point, I kind of thought to myself, I would love to do that, you know, but, you know, I've got young kids, now's not the right time, maybe in 5, 6, 7, 8 years, whatever, you know, it might be something that I'd like to do. And then my sister Pip went out to Antigua to see him come in. I guess it was a similar thought process for her, really. She saw him leave from La Gomera and she saw him finish in Antigua, and she was so hooked by the whole event that she knew in her heart of hearts that she wanted to do it. And then it was kind of fate, really. We were so lucky that the person that had bought Mrs. Nelson said, if there's another crew that want to use the boat, then I'll happily keep it for another year or another 2 years. And so Pip put her hand up, and a couple of weeks later when she got back, she called me and said, how about it? And I said, don't be ridiculous, can't possibly do it. But deep down I knew I'd do it, you know. It was, yeah, I just had to kind of get my head around it and then have a conversation with my husband. So I think I was probably the next person to jump into the crew. And then Jo was one of Pip's school mum friends, and Jo had said to Pip sometime before, when David was training for it and David was doing it, that gosh, he'd love to do something like that. Wow. So Pip said, you know, you said that thing, you know, a year ago. Well, how about it? And so Joe then jumped at the chance as well. And then our kind of fourth person revolved several times. I guess it's, you know, it demonstrates how hard an event it is, particularly as a mum, because there's all sorts of things going on in your lives, which, you know, aren't necessarily within your control. Or, you know, it's difficult to go away for that period of time and to dedicate that much time outside of the actual race to all of the training. So we had a couple of people that kind of were in for a brief time and then out. Then we had Paula, who had to retire most recently due to injury. And that's when Lebby stepped in. But I'll let Lebs tell you how she managed to get into the boat.
Yeah, so I basically, my connection with the crew was that I had rode with Joe at Oxford. And so we rode together in 1993 in the women's for Oxford in the women's boat race. And, you know, we've been kind of lifelong friends ever since. And also, I'm a journalist. So I'd first of all met the crew, I think, kind of in the middle of the pandemic. So we met over Zoom and I gave them a little bit of a sort of media briefing and kind of, you know, how to run the Instagram account and that kind of thing. And then a bit later on, I'd written an article for The Telegraph and interviewed Paula as well. And that had just gone out when Paula, I think, decided that she wouldn't be able to do it, that her back injury was too, you know, it'd be too much of a risk. And so I was sort of sitting at home one Saturday afternoon drinking wine in the back garden with my husband when Joe called and said, would you like to row across the ocean with us? And I mean, I was completely overwhelmed, but I knew in my heart of hearts that I really wanted to do it. And my husband was immediately supportive. And he was just like, you've got to do it. You know, if you don't do it, you'll regret it for the rest of your life. And I didn't say yes immediately. The only thing that I wanted to do was go on the boat. And I sounds ridiculous, but after my honeymoon, we'd come back from Sark in terrible weather on this tiny boat. And a tiny ferry, and I'd had terrible seasickness and then terrible land sickness, and, you know, feeling kind of really dodgy for days afterwards. And so I just wanted to make sure that I'd be able to get on the boat and that I would cope with being on the boat. And Mrs. Nelson was stationed in Gosport, and we went down and just had the most beautiful outing. You know, I think we were there for like a day. I was there for a day. And, you know, it was gorgeous. And I just loved boat life immediately. Just, you know, I didn't care about the tiny cabins or pooing in a bucket and that kind of thing. And I was overjoyed when the girls said, yes, they definitely wanted me to join the crew. So that was, I think, June last year? And then, of course, so obviously we were setting off on December the 12th. But what I kind of hadn't quite accounted for was that you have to do the 120 hours on the boat altogether. So all the time that the girls had done already sort of went back down to zero. So we then had to do this, fit in more weekends to try and get up to this 120 hours. And I had to do several courses like ocean rowing course, sea survival, first aid, short radio course and navigation and that kind of thing, which I sort of basically fitted in all during the summer. That all had to be done by September, I think. And then because in October the boat gets shipped, or late October the boat gets shipped, and that's it. So it was a sort of real baptism of fire. Mm-hmm. But I was already rowing, so I'd returned to river rowing as a master's rower a couple of years before. So, and I'd been training a lot, so I knew I was fit enough. It was just more the kind of question mentally, you know, the fear and the seasickness, but you know, I knew that I definitely wanted to do it, so I said yes, and the rest is history.
I remember you said in one of your articles that, I think it was in the Telegraph article, that nobody would blink an eye if fathers did it, and that was that what you wrote when you were the journalist looking at them and reporting on the crew doing this adventure, and that people were making, and it's sort of making a fuss about it and getting really excited about women doing this exciting adventure race. And is that how you then felt becoming part of the crew, that people were sort of, you were thinking, you know, if I was a man, maybe this wouldn't be quite such an exciting thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I think it was, well, you know, Pip's big point was, she's always brought her children, and she's got four kids, and she's brought them up to, you know, believe absolutely in equality and that women can, you know, do what they want. And she, I think she really strongly felt that you know, it was all very well for David to go across adventuring, you know, adventuring across the seas. But if she didn't do something like that herself, then what example would her children have to follow? You know, yeah. Well, they, in their heart of hearts, they might think, well, daddy's done this, but mummy hasn't, you know. And I think so that was a sort of big part for her. But, you know, there is, like, I only actually discovered when I came back that the crew that came third, five in a row, Scottish crew, these guys, they've got 10 children between them. But no one had ever mentioned that. It just wasn't a thing. It wasn't part of their posts. It wasn't, you know, they were just like, you know, it just wasn't even kind of, it's not commented on. Whereas, you know, people do, we had a lot of support and people were lovely, but people do raise an eyebrow, you know, when you say you're going, especially because we go over Christmas, yeah. And it's like, what your kid's going to do and how your husband's going to cope and yeah. things yeah. that no one would ever say to a bloke who's just said, right, I'm going to row across an ocean, you know. So I think that's, you know, we kind of, you know, it's a sort of slightly, it's double-edged sword that we kind of, we play on as well, because we, you know, we know that we got media coverage because we were mums rowing an ocean, yeah. you know, and we had this great feature on BBC Sport that went out just before we went, and the headline's literally mums row an ocean, you know. It's like, you know that guy, the man who has it all, he's got this great Twitter account.
Oh, yes, yes.
He's always kind of taking the mickey out of those yes. kind of headlines, you know, and it is, you definitely didn't have the same headline for the five in a row, dads row across an ocean.
No, it's just men you know, did yeah. something brave or...
Men doing manly brave things, you know. Women leaving their children, you yes. know, it is that difference.
Yeah, but I think having seen, so Pip's experience of having been the person left at home mm. 2 years ago, looking after the four children, and then the flip side of that being David left at home this time around looking after the four children. I don't think anyone really offered her any help or support. You know, I mean, she was just expected to get on with it and deal with it. It wasn't particularly remarkable that husband was away, leaving the yeah. kids and the wife for 2 months over Christmas. Yet the roles have been reversed, and suddenly, you know, there's this massive network of support for all of the husbands, because how could they possibly manage without the wives
yes.
over Christmas? And so it's brilliant for us that there was so much support, because actually I think it made us all feel a bit better about being away, mm. knowing that, you know, there were so many people helping out. But it's just very different. It's very different for the mums versus the dads in exactly the same situation. And it shouldn't
yeah.
be.
Yeah, no, it absolutely shouldn't be. And it's interesting because I have interviewed climbers and adventurers, you know, mountain climbers and adventurers and things, and they've all said the same thing. And it goes back through history. And it doesn't yeah. seem to have changed. And you just think the number of women who climb Everest, who, you know, ski to the North Pole, who have done South Pole adventures, they've rode the oceans, they've done all of these things. I know there aren't very many. And I noticed one of the points you make that only 75 all-female crews have ever crossed an ocean. In comparison to, I'm sure, I don't know what the statistics are for men, but I would imagine it's
100%. Yeah, I don't know what the, I did the, it's now 81, I think, now that everyone's come in and right. there's we've yeah. had even a few more. Now we've had Victoria Evans, who's just done the fastest solo female crossing ever, an amazing yeah. time. But I think it's, well, now it will be 252 women, so only 252 women have ever rowed an ocean. And I think that the men must be in the close to the thousands by now.
Yeah,
I reckon. So it is a big, and you know, this year actually, like, you know, for our race, we were a female four, the female four record was set in 2017, which was a very windy year, very fast year. So we didn't have a chance of breaking that this year, but women's trio set a world record, women's pair set a world record, and now Victoria Evans has set a solo record, not rowing but as part of Talisker Whiskey, but, you know, on her own. And I think that just sort of shows, like, there's just increasing involvement in women in ocean rowing, and it's had this kind of, you know, perhaps a little bit of a sort of macho image beforehand, you know, with people like James Cracknell doing it, and, you know, and I think that's really changing, and women now kind of seeing that they can do it. And, you know, this year we've really kind of set a kind of really fantastic example this year's race of some really strong female crews. We were incredibly competitive, you know, we beat some of the men's crews, we were faster than all of the mixed crews, which was very pleasing.
Wow. Okay, I didn't know that's amazing.
Well, all yeah. of the mixed fours, not There was one mixed crew. Right, yes. There was a mixed trio that just pipped us to the post.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That is true. The mixed trio, that was, she's a, Taylor is a Olympic, well, she was nearly in the Olympic kayaking team, I think, and she was great. So she was the first woman across the line. And then our rivals, One Ocean crew, pipped us to the post by a few hours. And we raced them. We were neck and neck over 3,000 miles across the ocean. And, you know, I mean, everyone said it was an incredibly competitive year, but that was our race with them was one of the closest races ever, really, in the history of the race.
So that's amazing for you to have to concentrate and push that hard the whole time. Did that feel like it made, did you go out there with the prospect of wanting to actually race, or did you go out there with the prospect of just wanting to stay in the boat and get to the other side without hating each other?
That's a really interesting question, and it's something that we talked about a lot before. We had an ocean rowing coach, Duncan, who kind of pressed us on it, you know, basically, are you in it to win it, or are you in it to get across? So it's compete or complete. And actually for us, it was always somewhere in between. We never set out to win the women's race to the point that we hadn't really even researched who the competition were. You know, for us, it was more about doing it in a way and at a time which we were really proud of. So doing ourselves proud, regardless of where we came versus other people. But I guess as the race unfolded, you know, within a few days, it became clear that we were in a competitive position against the other female four. And then, you know, the conversation started again. Well, what are we going to do here? Because you can't, if we wanted to go for it, we had to slightly change our tactics and be prepared to do things differently. So it was almost a conversation that went on the entire time, because as the race continued to unfold, you know, we had to dig deeper and deeper and deeper, and to the point where we were rowing probably 16 plus hours a day each, whereas the normal shift pattern would be rowing 12 hours a day.
Wow.
So we really did have to change what we did, which changed our experience. But I think it was actually a very positive thing for us. It certainly made both female four crews go a lot faster, because we were always kind of, where's the other crew? Where's the other crew?
Yeah.
But it did become, I mean, slightly obsessive at times. I think, you know, we were kind of living for the 4-hourly updates. Where are we versus them? Have we lost a mile? Have we gained a mile? I think, you know, particularly Levy, I think Levy's mood was very much governed by how we were doing. It's funny, you really learn a lot about yourself. And I think we all thought we were competitive. I think we all realized that we were pretty competitive when we were in that position, just slightly varying degrees, and, you know, varying degrees of how much we prepared to kind of slightly compromise our original, you know, ideals to go for it.
And when you started deciding to go for it and you sort of committed to that tactic, did you at any point go, oh, there's a reason why it's done in 12-hour shifts, and actually it started to take its toll? Like, you weren't actually getting to the point where it was still motivating you to keep on going and keep on pushing that hard, and things were sort of falling apart a little bit? Or I know Lebby had a little moment of realizing she might have quite a serious illness mid-ocean.
So the shingles, I developed shingles. Actually, that was before we started to really kind of pick up the hours.
Okay.
I mean, basically, you go off the first couple of days, you row. Most crews tend to do that. So you get a kind of a bit of a start, and then you get a shorter amount of rest. And then, but the normal shift pattern is 2 hours on, 2 hours off, two people rowing. And then if we found ourselves kind of, you know, basically within 2 weeks, we got to a position where we thought, like, we had the other crew in our sights. If we did three up for one day, we'd be able to overtake them. And we did that. And then towards the end, we started rowing three up again during the day. And it did take its toll on me. And so I'd already developed shingles. So I lost a lot of weight, and quite quickly, because I lost my appetite. And all of us, like, Pip was sick for the first 36 hours, but we didn't have seasickness, and we all adapted really well to life on the boat. But I think whatever reason, I don't know why, I just couldn't eat. And I really struggled to kind of finish my food. And, you know, things like Kendall mint cake and stuff kept me going. And nuts, I ate all the nuts. No one else was eating their nuts. And I was just, like, stuffing my face with nuts. So that, and then I sort of, one day I just noticed I had these little red spots under my left breast. And I thought it was a fungal infection. Obviously, we'd all been warned, you know, you've got to strip off all the time when you're not rowing to stop these fungal infections. But it didn't go away. I put the fungal cream on, didn't go away. And then it got worse and worse. And then it started getting pussy. And then I started getting a rash on my ribs. And so eventually Pip said, you've got to send a picture to the race doctor. So I was kind of there, like doing very dark version of Reader's Wives, taking pictures and then trying to get on the broadband, which was another issue and mission in itself, to send the picture over. And then, you know, they get basically just said, have you ever had shingles before? And I said, yes. And they said, well, it's probably shingles. And I, you know, I hadn't felt that bad, but it's kind of hard to tell when you're, you know, you're pushing yourself that hard. But I definitely struggled more than the others at keeping awake in the night. So I had some mad evenings where I would just fall asleep all the time. And I never rode with Dids, actually. So Dids is my cabin buddy. So we don't rode together unless we were three up. So mainly with Pip. So poor Pip was the one that kind of, Pip and Joe had to keep me awake. And then that got, by the time we were really racing at the end, when we were going three up during the day and having shorter rest time during the day, I think I honestly started to lose it. And then one night we tried to do it during the night, and the next day was not a happy day on the boat. I just remember at one point just going, I'm not happy. Oh. And just crying. And yeah, it was just like, and then the next morning we had a kind of normal night, and Pip was like, are you better today, Levy? And I was like, yeah, I'm much better. You know, so it was really interesting for me, because I had been a little bit of the boat policeman. Well, I say a little bit, a lot of the boat policeman. You know, I was sort of really like, right, it's, you know, sharp shift changes and no messing around, and let's, you know, always try and aim for 3 knots on the boat speed, you know, because 3 knots is the kind of, you know, that's what you really want to aim for. And then at the end I discovered that I'd reached the limit of how far I could push myself, and that was quite hard to come to terms with, I think. So, you know, it was a learning. I knew I was competitive. I sort of basically learned that I was incredibly competitive, but then had to realise that I had my own limitations too.
And what was really interesting, though, was how resilient we all were. I mean, yeah, we, you know, we reached our limits by the end of it, but at that point we raced for 2,500 miles. I mean, right. You know, for 30 something days. But our resilience was just unbelievable, considering we were, I don't know, between 1 and 2 decades older than the other crew. We were just able to dig deep and keep going and keep going and keep going, both physically and mentally. And I think that was a lesson for us all, was that age isn't really a factor in this whole thing, or it doesn't need to be a factor.
Yeah.
I think we were definitely the underdogs, because we were, on paper, this middle-aged bunch of mums. We're probably a little bit clueless, you know, technically clueless. What are they going to do? And then suddenly, you know, there we were from a couple of days in, really competitive. And as Levy said, against mixed crews, men's crews, all of the crews, you know, we were in the top 10 for a long time. And I think people just thought, wow, we didn't see that coming. And that was really, that gave us the buzz, it was really motivating.
It's interesting though, isn't it, that you kind of say middle-aged mums as if that's an insult, like,
yeah,
you know, and you're kind of like, Why would being a mum be something that means that you don't have great resilience, brilliant ability to be sleep deprived? You're great at dealing with psychological trauma as well as first aid at the same time as cooking for yourself and talking about going to the toilet, you know, like dealing with swords and you know, things that don't look particularly nice, because you've done all of that so many times. Yeah. Why would that be an insult that
you're a mum? You're so right, and I think it was one of our biggest advantages, was the fact that we've been there, done it, seen the pictures. And I actually think as well, because our daily lives, being working mums, juggling so many different things, daily life is so busy, you're constantly running from one thing to the next. Actually getting on that boat, all we had to do was think about ourselves, eat, sleep, row, repeat. And it was just a joy. The simplicity was an absolute joy. It was a privilege to be able to do it. And I think that made us enjoy it as a crew, probably way more than most of the crews out there. Because it was we treasured that time so much, because it was so different to normal life.
Whereas some of the younger crews might have been doing it as this is their sort of big adventure that they were doing as a competition to go and do something that they can write on a CV or have on their kind of adventure list that they've done. Whereas for you, it was a totally different part of your life. You were doing it for a different purpose.
I think that, you know, it's totally right, actually. Being a mum kind of makes you super, you know, super fit to do this. And I mean, there's no greater parallel for the sleep deprivation, the terrible sleep deprivation, than, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and feeding your kids, and, you know, really kind of thought back to that and remembered that your body can do that, you know, your body can survive. And, you know, that's definite advantage that we had over the younger crews, I think, you know. And when we came in, like, yeah, we were a bit battered and bruised and all the rest of it, but all of us always said we absolutely loved the crossing and it was amazing. Whereas, you know, some of the other crews, especially some of the men's crews, didn't enjoy it. You know, they hated parts of it. And I mean, I think everyone now probably looks through rose-tinted spectacles, yeah, how amazing it was. But yeah, you do have that advantage as a mum, you know, and it makes us good at endurance sports, makes us competitors, yeah, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Lots of the long distance runners, I think, have sort of saying these sorts of things, that they're incredible hundreds of miles endurance running. They're able to do it because of the things that they can draw on from what they know that their body is capable of going through. They have that total surety that they can sleep only for a short amount of time and their body can get up. Whereas I guess when you're younger, you have no idea. Hi Movement fans, sorry to interrupt your listening today. I hope you're enjoying the episode. If you are, I would love it if you could leave a review if you're listening on Apple Podcasts right now. If you're on your mobile on the app, click on the icon with this podcast image, scroll right to the bottom where you see the ratings and reviews section, and tap the number of stars you want to give. My suggestion would be 5. And then click the write a review link at the bottom. It literally takes 1 minute and makes a huge difference in how iTunes shows this podcast to others who are searching amongst all the thousands of brilliant shows that there are out there. Thank you so much for choosing this podcast and taking the time to review. It really does mean the world to me and I am hugely grateful. Okay, let's get on with the show. Now, going back a bit, you guys were all training through 2021, when we had the mixture of horrible lockdown. So Dids, when you were obviously in the training during the beginning lockdown, and Lebby, you didn't join until towards the summer. So although you were rowing training, but it was a little bit different. But how was that? You had homeschooling your kids, lockdown, so you guys couldn't actually sort of meet up, I presume, and train together, yeah, and you couldn't do training with other people. So you were having to train at home and homeschool your kids and work from home as well. So to me, lockdown was hard enough, let alone doing endurance training as well. So how did you manage that?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly challenging. I mean, there were many things about it that were challenging, you know. I mean, I think everybody found homeschooling combined with working a big challenge, and that was no different for us. But I think actually having this as a goal to train for was really helpful, because rather than just being, you know, depressed by the state of COVID, everything was going on in the country, we had this thing that we were aiming towards. And there was always a reason to get up early and to do your training. And it was actually really motivating, and I think probably made us all feel a lot better through that whole situation. But then, of course, it was challenging physically being able to meet up, because we couldn't meet up most of the time. We couldn't go out on the boat. So we were really lucky to have had our boat for 2 seasons to train in. But actually, the reality was that most of that time we couldn't get into it because of COVID and lockdown. When we were changing crew members, so when Paula joined the crew, we kept trying to arrange to meet up face to face to make sure it was a good fit. But every time, you know, another lockdown was announced. And so eventually we just had to commit to her being in the crew without ever having met face to face. And then, you know, our first training session on the boat together was cancelled because of COVID. So it was really hard. But then in some ways there were elements about lockdown that made it easier. So the fact that we were working from home meant that we weren't having to commute into work. So then you gained a couple of hours, extra hours in the day. And that for me was when I did my training. So swings and roundabouts, you know, I mean, it was tough in many ways, but equally the big swing towards home working that has stayed has been really advantageous from a training perspective, because you can fit in training before work or after work, because you're not doing all of that traveling.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it was tough, but it was the same for all of the crews. I think what was also really hard was that most crews rely on having fundraising events to raise money to get to the start line. And of course, most of those couldn't happen and had to be cancelled. And that meant that a lot of crews postponed from 2020 to 2021, which is why we were the biggest fleet that they've ever had. And still now there are crews that haven't been able to get to the start line because they haven't been able to do their fundraising. So it's been challenging for lots of different crews in lots of different ways. I think we're just all grateful we got there in the end, and somehow we managed to get to the start line, all four of us, without COVID. You know, we did have Joe tested positive for COVID the day we arrived in La Gomera for the race start, which was an absolute nightmare. That put so much stress on us as a crew, because whilst it was always probably very likely that Joe would get into the boat because she'd had enough time to get over COVID and test negative, the chances of one of the remaining three catching it and testing positive was so high. You know, every day we would test and we would wake up kind of thinking, do I feel okay? You know, you swallow and think, have I got a sore throat?
Yes.
Or there was just this awful level of, what would we do? If one of us got it, would we go as a three? Would we not go at all? Would we delay? And, you know, it was supposed to be those two weeks are supposed to be a brilliant time of socializing with the other crews, doing the final bits of preparation. And for us, we were kind of locked, the three of us weren't locked in the house, but I mean, we didn't socialize because we were so terrified of passing it on to somebody else. And then there was a lot of work for us to do because we were man down. So it was a really, those last 2 weeks were a really stressful time simply because of COVID.
And so presumably actually setting sail just made you all go, we're all here. Yeah. At least that's it. Yes.
Yeah. Because it looked like that wasn't going to be the case for quite a lot. You know, I mean, I think we just thought somebody else is going to get it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a miracle. I mean, I was sitting next to Joe on the plane, and I'd had my booster 10 days before, so I just think it was sort of serendipitous, really. But yeah, it was really stressful. And then we discovered something had broken on the boat. That is not the kind of thing that you have a spare for, and so the boat builders had to fly out this D-ring specially from the UK. And so we were the last boat, apart from, there were two other boats that had a real nightmare because they got stuck in customs in Tenerife, these two American boats. But apart from that, everyone else had got on the water, because you spend the first week in La Gomera, you sort out all your food, you have a boat inspection, you have to check that we've got all this equipment. And obviously there's a sort of picture of us with the last boat in the boat park. And it's just, you know, everyone else was sort of on the water and going out on training sessions, and we were still there and like still waiting to see if we were going to get COVID, and, you know, hoping that Joe didn't have long COVID, you know, and all of these things, and just the shit. Oh God. And then we had this horrific outing the day before, and I managed to almost break an oar and break a gate. And you honestly, it was so amazing, the camaraderie and the crew, and how lovely the other crews were to us. And honestly, we came in and we parked the boat, and I felt terrible. And, you know, we had a couple of gate spares, but you think, well, you need to keep them for the ocean row, you know, you need to keep them for the crossing. And suddenly one of the men from one of the other crews just sort of appeared with a gate, you know, and he was just like, and then, you know, and they, it just, honestly, it was amazing. And I kind of almost cried. And then by the next day, when we got on the boat for the start line, it felt unbelievable that we were actually going to manage to leave. And that morning, that was so fantastic. It's just such great, like one of the best days of our lives, you know, just going off to the cheering cruise in La Gomera, and did some Pips's mum and dad there. You know, I don't, my parents are dead. And so like Dids and Pip's mum and dad became sort of honorary substitute parents for me, you know. And it was so lovely to have them there. Yeah, and it's just incredible. And you go off and then you're like, what the hell is going to happen for the next few weeks? Yeah. You know, and it's you're into the unknown, into this crazy world of the Atlantic Ocean.
And I remember in one of your posts, it was the first night, the first, you know, some people were talking about the first darkness, that first sort of step into darkness, that was a really big moment for you. Was that one of the things that you had felt intimidated by before you left, was the sort of being away from land, suddenly not being able to see it on your own, and then night comes and you have to keep on moving around the boat and doing all of the things that you know that you're going to. Obviously, you were training, you'd done your training, but how did that, because reading that made me go, oh my goodness, I haven't even thought about that first night. That must be quite intimidating. So how did it feel?
It is the biggest thing that people talk to you about. So yeah, go on, Liz, say what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I think when you initially sign up for this thing, you feel that that's going to be a huge deal. But and maybe it was different for each of us on the boat, but for me, it didn't feel like a big deal at all. Okay. We had done nights on the boat in our training. I never really got worried about losing sight of land. That's the big thing for most people.
Okay.
You know, when you suddenly can't see anything but sea anymore. But I, you know, we generally adapted so well, so easily to life on board. And I do think it was, we were just so relieved to all be on that boat and actually finally doing this thing that we've been training for 2 years, that it wasn't really, we were also lucky actually that we had calm weather to start out. So we had a gentle introduction to life on the Atlantic. I say we were lucky. I mean, it meant that it was a very slow crossing. We had to row every mile ourselves. We didn't get much assistance from wind or waves, but it did mean that we weren't, with the exception of Pip, who was seasick for the first 36 hours, we didn't really get seasick. You know, it wasn't frightening because of the weather conditions to start with. So, but it was fine. Yeah. I mean, I think we thought, well, this is what we're here to do. Get on with it.
I actually remember feeling apprehensive on the second night. Funny, the first night, the water was kind of awful in a sort of horror, it was just slow and we just couldn't get any rhythm and it was difficult in that way. And the second night, I was the only time that I really sort of felt apprehensive, and I just remember the sun going down and it, you know, the water getting a bit choppy, and then that did feel quite overwhelming. And you do have, you know, you've got this sense of sort of being out there, and it's sort of weird in the first week, and you do kind of still get much more than when you come into Antigua, when you literally just see Antigua like 20 miles before you get there. I feel like we could see land for quite a long time. And then if you couldn't see land, the kind of cloud formations made it feel like you could still see land, you know. Yeah. And so you kind of really have this feeling that you were sort of going down, and you are going along the coast of Africa, I guess, even if you can't see it, you're going very far south. So it's not until you kind of turn right, I guess, if you're looking at the boat that way, and head out into the middle of the Atlantic, that you kind of, you know, you start to feel kind of, actually, we're kind of out here. And I think sort of post-Christmas, post-New Year, and when you read the first few nights, also you see the other boats, you can see the other nav lights. That's quite fun, you know. We did a sort of bit of racing, like we could see, you know, you'd see other crews, and we'd kind of get a kind of shift on at sort of 6 p.m. you know, and that was really good. But post-New Year's Day, I mean we didn't see anything or anyone until one day, like, just, you know, a few days before the end, we saw another boat about 800 meters away, and occasionally we saw a couple of liners before January, and that was it. Just us, birds, and the great circle of sea, and amazing sunsets.
Fish,
and
flying fish.
The flying fish. Yeah.
Lots of flying fish. They were the worst thing. They were the worst thing about it for me.
The kind of equivalent horrible. Of mosquitoes, but flying fish.
Yeah.
Massive.
And the first night was Christmas Eve. I mean, we had tiny ones, tiddlers, before that. But then Christmas Eve, we'd already had a kind of horrific day because the water maker had broken. And then suddenly, about 10 o'clock in the evening, this fish just launched itself onto the boat, hit Pip on the shoulder, crashed down into the gunwales, and then went into this sort of death rattle, you know, that they go through. And obviously, if you're brave, you'd pick up the flying fish and throw it out. But I didn't think we managed to do that until right at the end. It really is, and it's really sinister the first time it happens. And you immediately, they arrive on the boat, it smells fishy, and then when they're doing their death shake, you get covered in fishy bits. And, you know, and it just felt kind of really sort of ominous. And then indeed, 2 hours later, we spun out of control, and everything really did go wrong for a few hours, and our auto helm broke, and we had a row, and we had a terrible introduction to Christmas Day. Oh. when dawn broke on Christmas Day, everyone was crying, and then it wasn't great until we put on some Christmas music, and then Walking in the Air came on, and then a bird started soaring overhead. Do you remember, Dids? And then suddenly it was like, actually, it's going to be okay, and Christmas is going to be okay, and we can talk to our family, and we can having our boil in the bag Christmas dinner that this other crew, the Bubbleheads, had given us, and we played some games and had some Haribo, and things were okay in the end. But it was a hard day.
Yeah, it was. And was that one of the hardest days because everything all happened together?
Yeah, I think it,
I think it probably was.
Yeah.
And also Christmas Day was the hardest day. We always knew it's going to be the hardest day emotionally, because it's the one day when you really do want to be with, well, I say it's the one day, of course you want to be with the family all the time, but I mean, it's a very important day, isn't it? You know, you know, thinking of the kids opening their stockings without you, first time away from the family for Christmas. So we always knew that that was going to, you know, that was going to pinch emotionally. And then it, as Libby said, it came on the back of this tough night of all sorts of things going wrong, so it was probably the worst day on the boat, I think, probably.
Yeah,
but actually it wasn't that bad. We all woke up crying. That wasn't strictly true. We didn't really. I mean, I think I shed a tear when I spoke to my kids, but otherwise I was okay. It was fine.
Okay, so out of the thing, of the things that you were scared of before you left, so Libby, when Joe called you and said, do you want to come and row the ocean with us? And the things that immediately you were like, oh my goodness, this is what you felt, that any fear, or, and both of you, when you sort of contemplated it, did those things materialize, and were you still scared of them, or were they actually nothing to worry about, and the things that you were intimidated by or scared of, were they actually totally different things?
Well, my biggest fear was easy to, you know, I really sort of felt you had to come to terms with the fact that you may die if you do this. And, you know, no one actually has died doing the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge, but people have died crossing the Atlantic, and fairly recently. So my kind of big fear was that the boat would capsize, not self-right, and that we'd be trapped upside down, you know, in the floating in the middle of the Atlantic. And, there are some kind of scary YouTube videos of people that have been rescued, and they show you this picture of a boat that, you know, floats upside down, and that's simply to kind of make sure that you always close your hatch doors, because that's what makes you not self-right. So if you capsize and your hatch doors are open, they will fill with water and your boat won't right itself. So you do have to keep an eye on hatches and keep them shut most of the time. And, you know, but that didn't materialize. We didn't capsize, but we did have some really scary nights. And actually, like, I did manage to keep those fears to the back of my mind. And then when we were going through the really scary patch with the big waves and the wind, and you realize you can't feel fear in the way that you might do at a sort of one-off event that's scary, you know, because if you did, you just couldn't do it. Your body takes over, your mind takes over something, and you get through it. When I think back now to those nights, and I think, God, we were 1,500 miles away from the shore, and it was so dark, there was no moon, you couldn't see anything. And, you know, if something went wrong, if that happened to you, you'd probably be goners, you know. And that is quite weird. I find that quite weird looking back. But there was only one night where ostensibly, you know, we were scared, which is when, and that was, well, on me and Pip's shift. And, you know, there's this thing called pitch poling, where you can go, you ride the wave. If the wave breaks on top of you, it can push your boat backwards. So it's worse than a capsize, because you're flipping over backwards. And then we had this wave break over the top of the boat. And I was like, okay, well, let's put our life jackets on now. And that was the only evening we put the life jackets on. So that's a kind of measure of, and maybe on Christmas Eve, did put her life jacket on. And so that was it in terms of the really scary stuff, I think. But what do you think,
so leading up to it, I wasn't scared, I wasn't nervous. I always thought, when I first signed up, I thought the waves were the big thing that would terrify me. I don't like roller coasters, I hate that feeling of losing your stomach, and I thought that's what it might feel like when you're shooting down these big waves. So that was always the thing from word go that I was nervous about. But then as it got closer and closer, I just didn't feel nervous. I kept thinking, I must be burying my head in the sand. It's going to hit, it's going to hit, it's going to hit. And it never did. And, you know, we got in the boat, and I just think we all grew in confidence as we realised that we could do this, we are doing this thing. And then the weather gradually started to build. And actually, I really enjoyed the bigger seas, because they do get you there more quickly, especially in the day. I mean, it's very different day versus night. In the day, right, you can see the waves, you know. Yeah. you know that you're going to be fine because you can see what's coming at you. At night when there's no moon, you literally can't see anything, and you know your eyes are out on stalks desperately trying to see anything, but you can't see anything. Your ears are so alert trying to hear for these shooting waves that come from the side, and those are the ones to look out for or to be wary of, because those are the ones that can push you over. So yeah, there were a few nights when it was scary slash exhilarating, but actually I always felt quite safe and secure. Because even if the boats do capsize, they will flip up. We were always tethered on. We were very conscious of safety. Yeah, it was amazing, actually. And for me, it was a massive lesson in, I suppose, mentally how strong I am, how strong we were, to be able to get through all of that without really losing it, without really falling apart. And I think it's probably, you know, we did, well, apart from Levy, who joined the crew late, but I mean, we've been mentally and physically preparing for 2 years for it. And I think that all, you know, it all has to come together at the end. And it sort of saw us through.
And I suppose that preparation is what helps to calm the nerves or the fear, because normally fear is about something that you're out of control of, or that you haven't approached before and you've no idea what the result of that is going to be like. But by the time you've prepared a lot and been prepared for all of the scenarios, which is what is required of you to do it, presumably that gives you the confidence, I know how to deal with that scenario that I was initially intimidated by. It's now not so intimidating because I've been prepared for it.
Absolutely. And the Atlantic Campaign, to organise the event, do put you through your paces beforehand. They will not sign you off fit for race unless they believe that you are fit enough, you are going to be get across. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes you do feel like it's nitpicking and it feels like you're jumping through hoops. But actually, once you get on the boat and you start, you realise what an amazing job they do and how important that preparation is and all those rules are, because that's what makes you feel safe. That's what makes you feel confident, because you have done all of that training and you've gone through all of those courses and you've done that scenario, you know, scenario planning, which is exactly what helps you get through it.
Yeah. So what have you done with the, you know, all of that sort of mental toughness, that resilience and things? Obviously, by the time you got to Antigua, you were probably mentally and physically completely exhausted. You just needed to tone everything down and stop being, like you said, like really aware of what you were listening to and seeing and being on hyper alert all the time. So, but then as you've transitioned back into life, normal life, back at home, it's not really a question of what do you do next, but more of what do you do with what you've learned? How are you now then using what you've learned, or are you just happy not to have to be thinking about it any longer, just able to tell the fishy tales?
I think I definitely, you know, I came away with sort of a certain amount of boat resolutions, which I'm definitely sort of trying to sort of put in place in my life. I mean, I think I've probably got a slightly different situation to the others. No, I'm a freelance journalist, you know, my life is quite fluid, you know, and it sort of really made me think, is this really what I want to be doing for the rest of my life? You know, it's life changing, and that sort of becomes self-perpetuating because you want it to change your life. But I think what I discovered is that I just loved so much being part of this thing that's sort of bigger than me, you know, being part of a team, you know, just this being in this incredibly positive bubble. And, you know, so coming back and sort of working on my own, working from home in my office, you know, is challenging, but it, you know, it sort of make, I haven't got there yet, but it does make me think, you know, I need to put in a plan. I need to put a plan in place. So I think that's the sort of biggest thing that, you know, I really, you know, I did learn that I do love being part of an organization in that way, and a sort of bigger thing, and having a real purpose, because freelance journalism, you can sort of, you're living day to day, week by week, and you don't have much control over kind of what's happening. So I think that's probably my biggest sort of takeaway from it. I think it makes you, I mean, maybe harder is not, you know, because these things sound negative, tougher, harder.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
and maybe we should just say more resilient, but I think it has made me, feel those things. Maybe if you put it in a more positive way, that more able to kind of not let the small stuff kind of irritate me,
yeah.
you know, And because I have to, you know, and I find myself saying to myself, I rode an ocean, you know, I've battled worse than this, you know, an editor not replying to my email should not push me over the edge. You know, yeah. When I've been out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah, so that's definitely a big thing for me, I think.
What about you, Diz? Because so you like, in comparison, you're employed, is that right?
You
is it you that works for British Gas? No.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how was the return to sort of organizational work as a comparison to everything that you did?
Well, I mean, again, the transition, I didn't find it particularly difficult. I mean, my British Gas have been absolutely amazing. They were one of our sponsors. The chief, everybody's so supportive. I was their speaker for International Women's Day. And what I found really strange, I found it hard to accept, is all the praise. So many people going, you're just amazing, you're incredible, what you've done is unbelievable. And I kind of, I think it's a female trait to kind of bat it off, you know, say no, anyone can do it. And I'm really trying hard to accept that praise and to say, yeah, what I did was amazing. And I think it is a female trait. You know, we talked about it with Women in Sport, one of our charities, after the event, and that, you know, when men do these things, typically there's a lot of, you know, physically and metaphorically, yeah, bravado, exactly, beating of the chest.
Yeah.
We typically play it down, you know, we've done it, and that's the end of it. And I suppose the lesson for me is about being louder and prouder, because we need to be setting an example for other women, for our children, for children everywhere, that you can do these things. And the only way to do that is to talk about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have all done quite a lot of speaking events and things like that since. And I think it's been a real lesson that we need to be proud about of it, and we need to talk about it, the good bits, the not so good bit, to encourage other people to do the same. So I wouldn't say my life has changed dramatically as a result. I think there's this inner confidence now, because you know you've done this thing, you've done this amazing thing. And as Lebby says, you shouldn't sweat the small stuff now. You know, there are things that you shouldn't really worry about anymore, because you can easily get over them. It doesn't really matter anymore. But there is also this slight feeling of unrest now. You know, I thought at the time it's a once in a lifetime experience, that would be it. But now I loved it so much, I just think surely there's something else. There's got to be something else at some point in the same vein or a similar vein to get my teeth into, to give that goal, that something to kind of really work for.
And so are you cooking up some sort of adventure, whatever's next?
Not currently, no. I mean, there's also the, you know, the practicalities of being a working mum of three. You know, I can't just disappear off for months on end. Mm-hmm. And it was a massive undertaking for the husbands to be at home. You know, they were juggling work and children. So you can't just, you know, put that upon somebody else constantly, time and time again. So, but, you know, I do think in a few years' time, or in a period of time, there might be something. Yeah. I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
But also, I mean,
it's
tough just raising the money and getting to the start line for something like this. Probably as much as a challenge as anything else, as any other part of it.
Yeah. And also there's the physical side. You know, you did so much training, so much effort put in, so much strength work. I noticed, you know, greatly combining all the strength work as well as the endurance, and then obviously doing the row. Do you feel a little bit like you don't want to lose the amazing physical, you know, how great you are feeling physically? I mean, I'm absolutely sure you felt shocking physically by the time you got to the other side, but there must be something about that like real natural strength that you had to be, that your body got you to one side to the other.
I mean, I hate the idea that every day I'm losing fitness, I'm losing form. I really hate it. But then equally I think, well, there is no way you can continue to work out for 12 hours a day every day. So, you know, it's reality bites. But Lebby, you can probably talk to this better, because you've got a big event coming up.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, because I was doing the Masters rowing, and so I sort of keep in quite fit anyway. But just so happened that when I came back, I got invited to take part in the women's veteran, the first ever veteran women's boat race, which is going to happen this Saturday on the Tideway. And I was slightly worried about my hands, because they're still a bit stiff. But I just thought it was just too great an opportunity. So I've had to, in the last couple of weeks, I have got back in a boat. And I've started going off to the gym and getting on the rowing machine and doing some sprints. And, you know, you are really fit when you come in, but there's parts of your body you have to rebuild. So your glutes and your calves, you know, my scores on the rowing machine, and I've lost weight. So my scores on the rowing machine, not as good as they were, but I am, you know, it's great. I'm really excited about the fact I've got another event to throw myself into, and albeit it's going to be over in 10 minutes rather than 40 days, you know, give me that nice adrenaline rush that I'm afraid that I'm craving, you know. I mean, that's the thing. And I mean, I did marathons all through my 40s as well. And, you know, you do get into that thing, you know, all that training and all the rest of it, and you can put up with it because you know how amazing the adrenaline rush is at the end.
Yeah.
But I know, having done multiple marathons, that adrenaline rush starts to kind of lessen, you know, because it's easier and your body knows what you're doing. And, you know, so you do look for the harder and harder and harder event. You know, rowing is pretty tough. I mean, sprint rowing is pretty tough. So, you know, that does give you the requisite buzz. But yeah, after that, I'll probably go, you know, throw myself into a summer of rowing and see how I get on. But yes, it is really nice to have another challenge. But I'd love to do, it's just so hard when you've done the ocean row, because it's such an amazing thing. I mean, what comes close to that, and also what comes close to that and involves water, which is the kind of big thing for me. You know, I just love being on the water, near the water, you know. And I start to think I should learn to sail, really, and sail across the Atlantic, something like that. But you know, watch this space, we'll see what happens.
Definitely an open-ended thought there isn't a I am never getting back in a boat. It's definitely a, well, let's see what presents itself and let's see what happens. That's wonderful that it obviously hasn't put you off, so that's amazing. Thank you so much to both of you for being here this evening, for giving me your time. It was a privilege to speak to you, because I think what you did is definitely extraordinary and a really wonderful journey and amazing adventure for all of you. So thank you, and thanks so much for talking about it today. And I really hope you enjoy talking about it forever and ever, and never letting anyone forget that you crossed an ocean and all of the other things that you're going to go on and do afterwards, both of you.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been lovely to relive it all again.
I'm glad.
Yeah, we love talking about it.
Good, so you should do.